Chapter 7, The Yoga of Wisdom and Realization. The Holy Lord said, with your mind intent upon me, taking refuge in me now, hear how through the practice of yoga you shall fully come to know me. To you I shall explain in full knowledge and realization, which being known, nothing further remains to be known in this world. Of thousands of human beings, scarcely one strives for perfection, and of those adept in striving, scarcely any knows me in truth. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intellect, ego, principle, these are the eight divisions of my Prakriti, O Arjuna. Such is my lower Prakriti, yet know my higher Prakriti sustains all beings that exist and the whole cosmos mighty armed. These two Prakritis should be known as the womb of all these beings. Of this whole universe am I the origin and dissolver. Higher than me, Dhananjaya, there is absolutely nothing. All creation is strung on me like strands of jewels on a thread. I am the taste within water, the radiance of the moon and sun. I am Om in all the Vedas, sound in ether, manhood in men. I am the fragrance within earth, and the brilliance within the fire, the life in all beings and the austerity of ascetics. Know me as the eternal seed of all beings' intelligence, of the intelligent and the splendor of the splendid am I. I am the strength of the strong, free from all desires and from passion. I am the desire in beings that is according to dharma. States of being which are sattvic, rajasic and tamasic know as proceeding from me, yet I am not in them but they in me. All this world is deluded by the states composed of the gunas, thus it perceives me not, who am eternal and higher than these. This divine illusion of mine is difficult to go beyond. Only those devoted to me shall pass beyond this illusion. But those not devoted to me, evildoers deluded low, deprived by Maya of good sense, follow the way of the demons. These four kinds of virtuous men do worship me, O Arjuna. The distressed, seekers of welfare, seekers of knowledge, and the wise. Of them the wise man, ever steadfast, devoted to the one, excels. Supremely dear am I to him, and he is dear to me as well. All these indeed are exalted, but I see the man of wisdom as myself. He with mind steadfast abides in me, the supreme goal. At the end of his many births, the wise man takes refuge in me. He knows all is Vasudeva, how very rare is that great soul. Others deprived of their good sense, by this or that desire or right, devote themselves to other gods, impelled thus by their own nature. Whatever form a devotee may seek to worship with full faith, that faith of his is blessed by me to be steadfast, unwavering. Endowed with faith, he then receives his desires from that worshipped form. Because I have decreed that those desires should be granted to him. But temporary is the fruit for those of small understanding. To the gods go their worshippers, my worshippers come unto me. The unintelligent think me manifest, so unmanifest, not knowing my supreme state as unchanging and transcendental. Veiled by illusion, born of the combinations of the gunas, this deluded world knows me not, the unborn, the immutable. I know the departed beings, also the living Arjuna, and those who are yet to be born, but none whatsoever knows me. By desire and hatred rising, through duality's delusion, at birth all beings fall into delusion, O scorcher of foes. But those men of virtuous deeds, they whose sin has come to an end, freed from the pairs of opposites, they worship me with firm resolve. Those men who take refuge in me, seek freedom from old age and death, they know Brahman thoroughly and know the self and karma as well. Those who know me, the primal one, the primal God, chief sacrifice, they truly know me with steadfast thought even at the time of death. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, ends the seventh discourse entitled The Yoga of Wisdom and Realization.
Good evening. Welcome to our conference, to our class in the Awakened Life, the Bhagavad Gita and the Path of Action. It's, as always, incredibly sweet to be beginning this class and to be entering into the power that Krishna has unleashed into every moment, really, that we contemplate these teachings. So please find a posture in which you feel comfortable, and I'm having a slight voice problem tonight. And I believe that as we go on, it will work itself out. So we're going to begin, or to continue, by chanting our invocation. The invocation which says, I salute Madhava, Krishna, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and lets a cripple cross mountains. So taking a deep breath in and just allowing the breath to release with the feeling that the exhalation is being offered into the great breath. And we'll chant these verses with this same feeling of offering, feeling that your attention is seated in the heart, which is the home of that aspect of the divine, which in Krishna's language is called Vasudeva Tattva. Vasudeva means the indwelling light, and tattva means the principle. And that Vasudeva Tattva is Krishna's name for that inner divine being, that is the self, which is the place where the personal form of the divine as Krishna or as goddess or as Shiva actually reveals itself as the light of your own self. So we'll chant three times, and the words are on the sheet that you received at the very beginning of the class.
Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram Yat kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mokam karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram. Kripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Hari Om. So, with the breath flowing in and out, having the feeling that the exhalation is being offered, just allow yourself to come fully into the present moment. We're now a third of the way through the Bhagavad Gita. Today we're going to look at chapters 7 and 8. And Krishna, if you'll remember, has laid out two of the three wings of his core teaching, which he'll come back to again and again. The first chapters, of course, lay out the basic template of Karma Yoga, which is really the heart of the Bhagavad Gita, the yoga of action. And you'll remember that Krishna has made several basic points in his teaching to Arjuna. First of all, that action is not optional. As long as we have bodies and minds and perhaps beyond, we'll be impelled to action by the forces of nature, by the Shakti acting through the qualities of nature, the natural qualities that give life to our hearts, to our breath, to our bodies. And the second point he makes right in the beginning of the book is that each of us has obligations that are based on our innate nature as human beings, on our unique dharma, our unique duty, talent, skill. There are so many ways in which we define dharma, and also in the obligation to act in a particular way in a particular moment. And he points out that these obligations are the guides to action in daily life. And then three, he says that your life, your activities, are actually your path to self-realization and freedom. In other words, nothing about your life is an accident. It's actually the reality that you've been given in order to realize the truth. And finally, of course, his fourth point is that you are the self. You are free, you're unfettered, you're made of consciousness and love. And this is really significant. It's probably the most important thing about the Gita, that the self in you is the same as the self that is the heart of the universe. Yourself is divine consciousness. It pervades and underlies everything that is. So at this point in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is about to introduce Bhakti Yoga, the path of love, which is, of course, completely crucial to everything that is going to come next. And in his teaching to Arjuna, he's already offered two transformative practices, which we've been practicing. One is offering all your actions to the divine, and the second is meditating on the self. And his point is that with these two modalities, if we are living our lives and doing our actions, offering everything to the divine, and also spending time every day in contemplating the light of the self, then the path unfolds before us. And the kind of victory that Krishna is offering us, which is a truly righteous life, a life that is not only a service to the world and a service to the divine, but which also actually allows each of us to become what we truly are. So at this point, starting in chapter 6 and continuing on through the end, he's going to dissect the path of love. He's going to give us a means of joining our active life, our karma yoga, and our meditative life, our jnana yoga, with love. And he's going to unfold what is really one of the great offerings of the Gita, which is the understanding that there are indeed three paths that go together, and that all of which are necessary in finding the truth. And in fact, in this process, Krishna is going to give us what I think we could fairly say is the first integral path, the first truly integral path that the Eastern traditions unfolded. And I want to say that as we move forward into chapter 7, I'm going to again be following the commentaries of two of the most powerful enlightened teachers. As we've said, pretty much every teacher in India has commented on the Bhagavad Gita. It's one of the texts that everybody follows. And they've commented on it from different points of view. You know, the Bhagavad Gita is very often cited, for example, as a justification for righteous war. And it's also a justification for the kind of devotional, almost dualistic devotion, where, you know, you worship a God being outside yourself, greater than you, transcending all, offering your service and your devotion to someone other than you. For Jnaneshwara and Abhinavagupta, the divine is always within you and within everything. And for that reason, my experience is that they are the commentators on the Gita that are most helpful to us, because they really seem to have understood the heart of what is being taught here. So, again, Abhinava was an exponent of the of Tantra, specifically of that branch of Tantra that we call Kashmir Shaivism, though he had other traditions he practiced. So he interpreted Krishna's non-dual teaching in the light of his own tradition. And Jnaneshwar was a 12th century poet saint whose name means Lord of Non-Dual Awareness, who wrote his commentary on the Gita at the age of 16. Both of them were theistic non-dualists. In other words, they saw everything as one. They saw consciousness as intertwined with the entire material and subtle world. At the same time, they deeply worshipped a transcendent divine being. So for both of these teachers, you know, as for my teacher, my guru, there was this kind of a seamless weaving between the recognition that one non-dual truth pervades everywhere, and also that one non-dual truth is completely encapsulated and held and incarnated as a kind of supreme being with form. This is actually a really, I find, quite radical way of seeing the world, because it integrates what we could call normal religious tradition, that is the tradition that see the divine as a being, you know, theistic traditions, with the absolute non-dualism that recognizes consciousness as being at the heart of the world. And, you know, in India, and also in Buddhism, mostly in Buddhism, and certainly in what I call the California spiritual world, or the sophisticated, intellectually astute spiritual traditions of that many contemporary teachers called direct path spirituality, in which the practice is to meditate on consciousness itself. These traditions, these so-called non-dual traditions, generally speaking, don't acknowledge personal deity or personal divinity. I know that when I teach at non-dual situations, because I often teach goddess, I often teach a practice where we meditate on a form of the divine feminine and equate that divine feminine form with the all-pervading consciousness that that we experience within and without when we are in our most enlightened self. So people who follow the direct path will often say to me, how can you be talking about goddesses? Because everybody knows that the non-dual truth is beyond gender. It's neither masculine nor feminine. And, of course, this is absolutely true. And yet these great beings, Nineshwar, Abhinavagupta, many, many of the beings who are called siddhas, siddha meaning fully accomplished, because they're enlightened in a radical way that allows them to experience the entire physical world as their own body. In other words, their enlightenment is not about tuning into some bodiless, non-dual awareness where they're in this world but not of it. Their realization is a realization that they are completely one with the physical world. I've had, as I know many of you have had, experiences of this state, although certainly not permanently, but experiences where this strange paradox that the physical universe can be experienced within my own consciousness, and at the same time, along with it, there is a recognition that that consciousness is not mine, but is something much vaster and lighter. This particular form of enlightenment, which is really at the heart of the Gita, asks us to understand that this consciousness that's in everything, which also has a personal form, a very personal form that you can relate to as a friend, as a beloved, as a parent, is reached essentially through devotion. In other words, to begin to recognize this scintillating consciousness at the heart of everything as being both impersonal and personal requires devotion, which is why what Krishna is going to go on to unpack now. And it, again, for those of you who are familiar with Indian philosophy, especially with traditional non-duality, you'll remember that Indian philosophy makes distinctions between the absolute with form and without form. The absolute with form is called Saguna Brahman, that is, the absolute which has qualities, like Krishna, you know, who's in the visions that people have of Krishna in the paintings. You know, he's a beautiful, often depicted as a beautiful teenage boy with blue skin and a peacock feather in his hair. You know, he has a form, he has qualities, and on a subtle level, he has the qualities of love, of majesty, of empowerment. You know, they're qualities that the divine has, that the divine manifests. And then, again, in the non-dual tradition, there's the form of the absolute that is without qualities, which is called nirguna, or without gunas, without the aspects of reality that create distinction. So what Krishna is going to really show Arjuna and hopefully us is that the absolute with form, the absolute with qualities, appearing in and as the world, and also appearing as personal deities, that in every way this divine presence is findable in the world. This is the knowledge that Krishna wants Arjuna to get. And when he begins chapter 7, he starts to explain to Arjuna some of the forms in which it's possible to find the divine in the midst of the world. And the two words he uses are jnana, which of course means knowledge of the self in Krishna's terminology. Jnana always means the recognition of consciousness as the true self. And vijnana, which is a word that those of you who've taken my classes in the Vijnana Bhairava will be very familiar with. Vijnana means essentially the application of that recognition of consciousness as the self, the application of that knowledge to experience. So vijnana is applied knowledge, experiential knowledge. And part of what, you know, Krishna has shown us in chapter 6 is how to meditate, how to do indrawn meditation, how to turn inside, still the mind, focus on, in this case, the mantra. He's given us a mantric form to focus on, and that's part of what we were doing last week. That once you have meditated and discerned your own awareness, had a glimpse of your own awareness, had the recognition of that scintillating truth at the heart of everything, broken down your identification with the body and senses, you know, kind of deconstructed yourself so that you have come to realize that when you say I, you know, you mean the I, you don't mean the body, you don't mean the personality. You have actually learned to recognize that your true self is consciousness, is that which remains present, even when the body is asleep, even when the ego is smarting, even when you feel unloved, you know, even when you've done something brilliant, you have begun to recognize that your true self is free of all physical sensations, of all emotions, even of your most enlightened thoughts, and to recognize that and to identify with it. Vijnana is how you live it. When you have experienced that your true nature is pure consciousness, then how do you put this knowledge into practice? How do you approach your actions in order to be acting with the maximum amount of power and effectiveness? In other words, how do you live with knowledge? That's basically what the Gita is about. So in chapter 7, which I'm going to read a little bit of to you, Krishna begins to explain how to experience vijnana, in other words, how to take the knowledge that he's wants to unfold for us in meditation and essentially see God in the world, see God in each other. So he does a little bit of metaphysics. He explains a little bit of metaphysics, non-dual metaphysics. In verse 4 of chapter 7, he says that the elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, which are the traditional elements out of which the universe is made, along with mind, intellect, and the sense of egoism, which are in the Indian tradition, the elements at the heart of nature and also the inner psychic instruments, which in Sanskrit are called manas, buddhi, and ahamkara, the mental capacity to discern what's going on through the senses, the the quality of objective judgment, which is called intellect or buddhi, and the feeling of being a particular individual, that all of these qualities which create the personality self, the personal self, you and me, as well as the physical world, come out of what he calls his lower nature, his material nature, which is called prakriti. And I think most of you know the word prakriti. Prakriti literally means nature. It's the primordial substance out of which the whole material world comes. So the teaching of the Indian, almost all the Indian darshanas or philosophical systems, is that what we call the physical universe has its origin in a subtle substance, which we could say is the energy behind the Big Bang, in fact, or the energy that that is going to make the sperm and the ovum come together and grow into a human being. You know, I like to think of Prakriti as that subtle thing that happens inside the cocoon when the worm goes into the cocoon and emerges as a butterfly. Somehow, something has happened in there. Some energetic transformation has occurred in there, and all of that is based in Prakriti. So Krishna says, this is my lower nature, this is my material nature, but my other nature, my higher nature, is the self, is consciousness, is in fact Shakti herself. And Krishna then says, realize that all beings have their birth in this, have their birth in the self, have their birth in that consciousness, which is beyond everything. I am the origin of this entire universe and its dissolution as well. Nothing exists that's higher than me. Everything is strung on me as consciousness, like pearls are strung on a string. So what Krishna is really saying is that what we consider the objective world is emanating from inside the subject, the I, and that the I is Krishna. In other words, everything that is being experienced through our senses is actually being projected from Krishna's consciousness. So it's important to realize this because what it helps us understand is that it's not just that awareness allows us to experience our life. Awareness itself is actually the origin and the source of life. Now, we have a kind of limited experience of this, perhaps due to the insights of Carl Jung, who pointed out to us that the way we experience our life very often depends on the templates that we're holding in the mind. So if you're afraid of dogs because you had a difficult encounter with a dog when you were a child, then you may carry into your adult life a fear of dogs so that when you see a dog, it will look like a threat. That's a very superficial example of the phenomenon of projection. But that phenomenon of projection is, in Eastern philosophy, considered to be what actually happens when we experience a world. And so as Krishna points out, the origin of this world, the origin of this universe, is the projection of Shakti, arising from within the undifferentiated absolute, and then beginning to create a pre-physical manifestation, which is what's called Prakriti, which eventually gives rise to a denser experience of the physical world, becoming an energetic matrix, an energetic womb that Krishna will then call my lower nature. And I'm saying all this just to kind of, because Krishna finds it important to get this straight for us. So one of the ways that I like to understand Prakriti as the natural substance which keeps the world in order is in terms of that very beautiful cave painting, 40,000-year-old cave painting in France, where which you may have seen pictures of in the, you know, one of the books about those caves, in which there's a drawing of a vast female figure with animals and plants emerging from her vagina. And this is, you know, clearly a drawing of Mother Nature. It's actually a drawing of Prakriti. And again, as many of you know, Prakriti is made up of three energetic qualities, which are known as the three gunas, or the three, that's usually the word guna is usually translated as quality of nature. And the three gunas, again, I know I'm. This is something that many of you are aware of. The three gunas are called sattva, purity; rajas, passion, intensity, and activity; and tamas, darkness, sleepiness, and many of the qualities of ignorance itself. So, there's an entire philosophy built around the gunas, and once we start to notice them, as Krishna will tell us, we begin to be able to recognize them in every aspect of life, and we begin to realize that our entire material world, our life, is actually not only derived from, but actually experienced as the play of these three qualities of nature. Solid objects, you know, furniture in our bodies, have more of the density of tama guna, the denser guna. Living creatures have more of the rajas guna because they're constantly moving and acting. Light has more of the qualities of sattva, or clarity. But what we come to see is that all of these qualities are, you know, constantly interweaving with each other like strands of a rope. So one of the, you know, things that's going on in the world right now, especially in the American political world, is this overflowing of what I would call intense rajas guna, as the new president does all these, you know, executive actions that create chaos and upend everything that we've been taking for granted in the way our government interacts with the world. This is rajas guna in action. So, and the qualities of rajas guna are intensity, are overwhelming activity, are quick anger, are intense desire, greed, etc. So part of what disturbs us, you know, as we look at events like the events that are going on, and I'm talking about this because several people have asked me to, what we're seeing in a certain sense is a demonstration of the intensity of Rajaguna in a world, you know, or let's say a mindset in which there is no recognition that the sacred exists in the physical world. Because the quality of Rajaguna is that one feels very much identified as a separate person, and one deeply desires to affect the world, to get what one wants, to punish one's enemies. Endless, ceaseless activity, done for self-seeking purposes is the quality of Rajaguna. The quality of Sattvaguna, which is very much the quality that traditional meditators cultivate, the quality of Sattvaguna is quiet, stillness, clarity. It's the quality that allows us to kind of stand apart from the world and observe it. The intellect, the buddhi, is a very sattvic part of our nature. And one of the things that confounds spiritual people when we're faced with a situation such as the situation that is present in, you know, in the American political system right now, is how do you maintain your connection to the clarity of Sattvaguna while hopefully acting purposefully in the world in a situation in which what we could call the lower gunas, the qualities of ambition, greed, passion, and anger, are operating without, it seems, any checks or balances. So the, you know, the paradox that so many of you are facing is, how do you act purposefully in a way that that is effective while yet maintaining some degree of detachment and some degree of sattva? So this is essentially what the Bhagavad Gita is telling us, is how to do this. And part of what Krishna wants to make clear to Arjuna is that in this game of winning the battle, whether it's the battle of external life or the battle that goes on within the soul, it is absolutely necessary to cultivate the quality of sattva, both because it's the quietude, the stillness of sattva that allows us to become still enough to know the self, but also because the quality of sattva is the quality that allows us to really stand aside from our actions and know what is skillful. So one of the deep truths that Krishna tells us, and that is one of the sort of underlying truths of the Bhagavad Gita, whatever practice you're doing, is that it's utterly necessary to clarify the inner space of consciousness, to focus, to let consciousness fall back on itself. But Krishna is also saying that this is not enough. In other words, we actually need to learn to understand that that tattva, which is Krishna, is present in every particle of the world, which means that it's present in Rajas Guna. In other words, Krishna is fully present in Donald Trump and all of his works. Just as Krishna is fully present in aspects of the physical world which seem horrific, this is the essential understanding of the yoga he's teaching. And he says it in book 6, verse 30, one who sees the self in all beings, and all beings in the self, is established in yoga. So, deep breath in. Allow the breath to be offered into the great breath. And we're going to follow Krishna's instructions for meditation. So begin to allow the breath to flow naturally. And we're going to practice with the sixth chakra, the Ajna chakra. So I'd like you to feel that the breath flows in as though there were an opening in the forehead, and the breath could actually come in and out of that region just above the hard palate that we call the Ajna Chakra or the sixth chakra, which is the seat of the illumined mind. These are Krishna's instructions for the meditation that we practice at all the crucial moments of life, including the moment when we're facing death. Feel that in this place, just above the hard palate, where the breath is flowing in and out, feel that there is a miniature sun. That is, that in the very center of the head, there is a golden sun, and the rays of the sun flow through your head, through your body, to all sides of your body, and up into the subtle realm. And as the breath flows in, feel that the breath says the mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya. So with the inhalation, the mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya, I honor and bow and surrender to the great self that pervades all that is and yet transcends it. Just allow those syllables to flow in and out, flowing into the center of the head. Om Namo Narayanaya, flowing with the breath into the sun, in the very center of the head. Feel that the light of the inner sun is the form of the divine within you, that the sound of the mantra is Krishna's sound form. Recognize that we could call this light Shiva or Durga or Kali or Lakshmi or Krishna. Right now we're experiencing it as the inner sun. With your next inhalation, see if you can allow the light of the sun and the sound of the mantra to flow from the third eye center down through the center of the body into the heart, into that region in the center of the chest. And with the exhalation, feel it flowing back upward into the sun in the third eye. So with your awareness flowing with the mantra and the breath, flowing from the third eye down to the heart, I want to read you some of what Krishna is unfolding here. This is chapter 8. I'm sorry, this is verse 8 of chapter 7. And he says, I am the taste in water, O Arjuna. I am the light in the moon and the sun. I am the syllable Om in all the Vedas and the scriptures. I am the sound in ether. I am the quality of manliness in men. I am gender itself and femininity in women. I am the pure fragrance in earth and the brightness in fire. I am the life in all beings. And I am the meditation of meditators. I am the intelligence of the intelligent. I am the splendor of the splendid. I am the strength of the strong, devoid of desire and passion. I am the Icha Shakti, the power of desire, existing in all beings. And whatever states of being that might exist, whether they're sattvic, rajasic, or tamasic, know that they come out from me. They are in me, and yet I transcend them. So again, I want to just go through this a little bit, and I want to point out to you that part of what he's saying here is that, you know, he's talking about the sensory experience of the elements, you know, so the quality in water, in the quality in fluidity is taste. The quality in fire is sight, is brightness. The quality in earth is fragrance. These are part of the esoteric understanding of what it is that makes up the world. But what Krishna is really saying, that in you and I, truthfully speaking, which allows us to experience fluidity, is him. That in you and I, which allows us to experience solidity, is him. That which allows us to see forms is him. Him, of course, is it's a saguna word, because he is not a he. He is beyond gender, and yet he is Krishna. He is a divinely masculine form of consciousness. So this is a very deeply subtle fact, what it is that allows us to taste, what it is that allows us to smell, what it is that allows us to see, is the divine, which is the essence of the entire experience of the world. And it's very interesting that he's talking about seeing him in our sense capacities. Because in saying that, he's reminding us that the physical world is not other than us. In other words, it's the divine itself that is experiencing this world in all of its manifestations, even when what is being experienced is completely masked by its physical and emotional properties. So Krishna is the essence, God is the essence. And when he says, I am the intelligence and the intelligent, he's not just referring to our IQ, he also is referring to that fundamental natural intelligence that allows life to evolve. He is actually talking about the three divine powers, the three great Shaktis that emerge from the divine and take form as will or desire, as knowledge or intelligence, and as action. So, in other words, our experience of strength or activity, our experience of desire, our experience of knowing is simply a reflection of the power of knowing that arises out of the divine. And part of what Krishna is saying, of course, is that every form of desire, every form of intelligence, every form of strength, every form of beauty is an aspect of the divine desire, intelligence, and beauty. He's pointing out to us that whatever we see that strikes us can be seen as an emanation of Krishna's reality, and also, and this is one of the ways that I like to see it, as one of our own superpowers. So in other words, Krishna points to gifts, he points to intelligence, he points to strength, he points to beauty, he points to the powers that all of us exhibit in one form or another. And he's saying that any skill that you exercise, including the simple skill of being able to pick up a glass, is an expression of Krishna. So Krishna's Shakti, the divine energy that thinks your thoughts, that sees through your eyes, that smells fragrance, that expresses itself through your speech, through your talents and skills, that loves through your love, that is him, that is his. And so this is his essential pointing out instruction, to see that it is the self, it is your consciousness, which is my consciousness, that is playing as the world. So I know we keep coming back to this, but I'd just like to give us the opportunity to tune into that recognition, which is really the great non-dual recognition. Your eyes are closed. You're allowing the breath to flow in and flow out with the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya. And one of the reasons that we practice with the mantra, that we practice with this particular mantra, which I know that several of you have found really powerful, is because in mantra, in practicing with mantra, we are invoking and allowing ourselves to be empowered by the energy of the teacher who is expounding this philosophy to us. So Krishna is present in this mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya, and therefore, as we breathe the mantra, we are taking in Krishna's intention to show us his presence in the experience of hearing, in the experience of seeing, as well as in the awareness that it is our awareness itself, our consciousness itself, which allows us to experience this world. So whether your eyes are open or closed, see if you can recognize for a moment that the, for instance, the feeling of wetness in your mouth, the experience of hearing my words, that subtle process by which your intellect makes sense of the words that you're hearing, the illuminating quality in your vision if your eyes are open. All of this is Krishna. All of this is the power of the self manifesting through your senses. So perhaps in this moment you're recognizing that, perhaps you're not. And in verse 13, Krishna explains why. He says, because all beings are confused by the three states of existence that we describe in the word gunas. Because the gunas, the qualities of purity, activity, and dullness, which are the strands of energy that make up everything inside and outside, because the gunas confuse us by making everything feel separate, feel different, feel outside us. So the gunas are like the colors and shapes of a kaleidoscope, or like the images in a virtual reality show. They completely mask the underlying light of awareness. And of course, as most of you know, this masking of reality is actually a completely natural effect of the veiling power of the Supreme Shakti, which is also known as Maya, which is the veiling power that comes down naturally when this universe begins to manifest outside of the divine mind, even though it's always inside the divine mind. And, you know, as we've now come to understand through brain science, the brain and nervous system are completely hardwired to give us the experience of the gunas, the experience of separation and differentiation. So our very mind and senses are filled with the gunas, with the three qualities. The gunas are in our moods. The gunas are in our inner psychic instruments. The gunas are in our brain. They're all dancing inside us. And again, it's all inside Krishna's great mind. The thing is, he says to Arjuna, it's almost impossible for you to see this because my Maya is so strong. And as that, you know, all of this, everything that Krishna is saying to Arjuna is by way of explaining to him why he needs Krishna's help in order to know the truth. And I want to read you an expansion of this of these thoughts, these verses 14 and 15, through the words of Jnaneshwar Maharaj. His commentary on the Gita, which is actually written in the form of the dialogue itself. So his verses are actually expansions of the very pithy verses in the Gita. And he describes the world illusion, the world of the gunas, as being like a river in flood, a powerful river that's nearly impossible to cross. If you're living in California in a neighborhood like mine, you might have seen some floods recently, some flooded rivers recently. It actually is a very good metaphor for the power of illusion. So he describes the process, starting innocently, so to speak, with the desire of the Shakti to manifest a world. And these are his words. First, there gushes out of the mountain of the Absolute a stream in the form of desire. And by desire, he's talking about the great desire, the great creative desire of the Absolute, you know, the primal desire that is the source of the world. And from that, he says, the great elements, earth, air, fire, water, ether, emerge in small bubbles. with showers of rain from the clouds in the form of the three gunas. With showers of rain from the clouds in the form of the three gunas, the great flood of delusion of Maya swells the stream and sweeps away the cities of restraint and self-control. So he started out by describing the, you know, the fundamental process of creating a world. Now he's getting into our experience. The whirlpools of hate and the cross currents of envy swirl on its surface. Eddies of worldly affairs and the rapids of right and wrong action on which the weeds of pleasure and pain are swept along. Again, we're talking about the world illusion, which is so powerful. The billows of lust dash against the island of sexual love, and masses of souls are cast upon it. In the stream of egotism, spouts of infatuation with learning, wealth, and power gush out. Do you recognize any of this? As waves of sense objects leap forth. So, in other words, he's describing the endless distractions, the endless emotions, the endless opportunities that arise just in the natural course of life to more deeply experience separation. So Krishna goes on. He talks about how we're tossed around in confusion, tumbled by passion, the qualities of Rajaguna as we endlessly search for happiness. The currents of darkness and sleep, he says, are powerful. Tamaguna is very powerful. After all, you spend a third of your life asleep. And then he says, even the stillness of meditation, which is filled with the pure happiness of Sattvaguna, can drown you. So in other words, stillness isn't enough. Meditation isn't enough. Because even in that stillness, you can, as we all know, still be experiencing your separate existence. You can still be feeling, okay, I'm meditating and I'm experiencing stillness. So then he goes on to say, so people try to get beyond delusion, to cross Maya, to swim across this ocean by their own efforts, only to get caught in the currents. And I love this section because it's so psychologically accurate. He says, those who have tried to swim across it with the arms of their own intellect have been lost. You can't figure it out, right? Your intelligence, your intellect won't help you see through Maya. Some have been sucked into the deep pool of knowledge by their own pride. Some have been sucked into the deep pool of knowledge by their own pride. I don't know about you. I recognize this very deeply. You know, I've done so much inner work. I've had such deep experiences of the truth. You know, what more do I need to know? You know, that feeling of being a true seeker is so strong. Others have tried to cross it on the raft of the scriptures, but since they had stones of egotism attached to them, they get infatuated with their own brilliant analysis, those are my words, and drown. Others were devoured by the crocodile of sex or got caught by the confusion that sets in old age. And he goes on quite eloquently, Yaneshwar, about everything that happens to you as you get old and sick. Others, he says, get trapped by rituals or by self-imposed rules and discipline. In other words, Krishna says, Maya, the play of the movie, you know, of this virtual reality show that we're all living in, is so powerful that nobody can get to reality on their own. And it is the big secret in the Gita, even though Krishna is going to talk a lot about the different yogas and how important effort is, what he basically believes and teaches is the path of grace, the path of redemptive love, the path of divine help. So this is what he's telling Arjuna, you know, and he's saying it out of love. There's such a powerful tradition of teachings coming from the divine, from the highest, from the gurus, from Shiva to Shakti in the Vijnana Bhairava, the teachings coming from the overwhelming love that the divine has for the soul. You know, in Kashmir Shaivism, of course, we say that because Shakti herself, because the divine herself has veiled herself, she has to remove it herself. In other words, we're not deluded because we're stupid. We're not deluded because we made a mistake. This is really, really important. We're not deluded because there's something wrong with us. We're deluded by design. In other words, the Maya is there in order to create this amazing tapestry of differentiation for the sake of eventually the self, the light of awareness that's, you know, kind of buried inside the play, in order for the light of awareness to start to recognize itself. But when Krishna is telling us that the egoic self can't know the truth, that we can't pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, what he's actually doing is inviting us, and this really is the invitation of the Gita. He's inviting us to turn to the beloved, to the power of what in Christianity is called redemptive love, to that force within the universe that wants to wake itself up through us. And if the Gita has one overwhelming message, it's this. It is, you need grace. You are never going to figure it out without grace. So Krishna says, only those who take refuge in me can cross this river. In fact, Yaneshwar, in his commentary, in his expansion, says, the waters of Maya have vanished for those people who take refuge in me, even while they are still on this shore, even while we're in worldly life. Through devotion, through offering, through the grace of the divine, we can see with our open eyes the divinity within the physical world. Now, I just also want to say that this statement, only those who take refuge in me can cross this river, it probably sounds very similar to what Jesus says. You know, it's, no one can find the Father except through me. It is a profound statement about the importance of grace. And if you are a student of Kashmir Shaivism, you know, of non-dual tantra, you know that the power of grace, in Sanskrit it's called anugraha, is one of the intrinsic powers or shaktis of the divine, and that just as the divine is constantly creating, sustaining, and dissolving worlds, concealing herself within them, the divine is also revealing herself. Meister Eckhart says, the workman is hidden in the work. You know, the creator is hidden in the creation. The divine, the self, is hidden behind the gunas inside this Maya. But when Krishna says, only those who take refuge in me, or when Jesus says, only those who take refuge in me, of course, he is not saying, you know, you have to take refuge in this particular form of the divine. He's not saying, I, Krishna, am the only way, as opposed to, you know, Shiva or Durga or Allah. He's saying, I, the power of grace of the divine are the only way. So what we take refuge in is whatever form of the self we feel close to, whatever form of the self we can find. And one of the corollaries of this, as we get deeper and deeper into the tantric practice that Krishna recommends, is that whatever it is that you love, or whatever it is that you practice with, whatever it is that you turn to, the secret is to see the divine in them. And whatever form of the higher power you turn to, ultimately you're turning to that one supreme being who moves through all forms. So a deep breath in, and an exhalation that is the offering. With your eyes closed, with your attention on the breath, allowing the breath to flow in to the sixth chakra, and then with the inhalation, and then flow down to the heart, flow back up to the sixth chakra through the central channel. Centering yourself with the breath. Going to do a very short visual journey. The breath flows in through the center of the forehead down to the heart. The breath flows out from the heart back up to the third eye center. Find that center, whether it's the third eye or the heart. Find that center where the breath and your attention feels most comfortable. The breath flows in and out, but basically your attention is taking rest, perhaps in the heart, perhaps in the center of the head. It's going to depend on your nature right now. Some of us feel most present when we focus in the heart, some more present when we focus in the center of the head. So finding that place where you can center yourself. Imagine that you're seated in a mountain grove, looking out over a vast sky. In the midst of the sky, you see a form. And that form may have very distinct features. It may be masculine or feminine. It may be light. It may be have an animal form. It may not even be visually accessible. It might just appear to you as a feeling. What your intention is to open yourself to the experience of that in which you can take refuge. The form that you are invoking or tuning into is above all a form whose essence is love. The existence of this form of grace, which may be very specific or not specific at all, is the condensed presence of divine love, which you may experience as a kind of ecstatic, very present feeling, or as a very slight feeling of tenderness or affection. Just allow yourself to be present to the recognition that sacred presence, sacred grace, is there with you, here with you right now. And have the thought, I take refuge in divine presence. Divine presence in a very particular form, if that feels right to you, if that is what has appeared, divine presence simply as the felt experience of grace. With each inhalation, feel that that sacred presence is flowing into your being, and with each exhalation, feel that you're opening more to that presence. And feel or imagine now that this gracious presence wants to flow into you with the breath, wants to infuse you with grace. And so allow the energy of presence, the energy of grace, to flow in through the third eye center and into the heart. Or into the heart and up through the third eye center, depending on where you're seated. And allow this presence, which is grace, to infuse your entire physical and subtle body. So in this opening to divine presence, in this opening to taking refuge, feeling that with every breath you're allowing this beingness to infuse you. Your eyes are still closed. Krishna says to Arjuna at this point, four kinds of people turn towards me. And everyone who turns towards me, he is saying, is good, is virtuous. That is, anyone who turns towards the divine is participating in this grace flow. The virtuous ones who worship me, he says, are of four kinds. The distressed, the seeker of worldly success, the seeker of knowledge, meaning knowledge of the self, and the knower of reality. Four kinds of people seek me. The distressed, the seeker of worldly success, the seeker of knowledge, and the knower. And I want to contemplate this verse a little bit with you because it's, first of all, very psychologically acute, but also because it makes one of Krishna's really powerful points, which is that, as he's going to say in the next verse, whatever reason you have for seeking divine presence is valid. This is really important because for many of us, our turning towards the divine comes about through reasons that, you know, that are totally coming out of our suffering, our pain, out of our desire for a better life. And part of what we can recognize as we look at this list and as we think about it in our own life, which I'm going to ask you guys to do this week, is that we start to see that our relationship to grace, our relationship to divine presence, our relationship to the inner self is both developmental, that is, we pass through these stages, but it also includes all of these reasons and ways of turning towards the divine. And as Krishna will say later, any moment, any way that we turn towards the sacred source is going to get a response. It's going to make a difference. It's going to transform you because grace is always ready to flow into us when we turn to it sincerely. So one by one, the distressed, you know, we turn to the divine when we're mentally or emotionally or physically suffering. When there's nowhere else to turn, we turn to the divine. And it's actually very humbling and beautiful and powerful to feel your own powerlessness, to feel scared and uncertain, and to realize that in that uncertainty you can take refuge. I actually tend to do it automatically when on planes, when the plane is taking off or landing, and I'm not actually freaked out by planes, by flying, but there's always this moment of nervousness and at takeoff and landing, and I'm sure that there a lot of other people in any cabin of any plane I've ever been on who are doing the same thing, just asking, okay, can whatever divine presence there is in the atmosphere uphold this plane? I would also say that one of the ways in which distress has been a very powerful vehicle for me, and again, for maybe for many of you, a very powerful motivation for turning to the divine is when I'm experiencing the stress of personal remorse, when there is something in my character or in my behavior that I know, I have seen and feel powerless to change, and turn to God in order to experience some relief in that. You know, it's of course the great 12-step movement recognition that you turn to the divine because you realize you're powerless over your addiction. And, you know, every one of us knows how significant that is. It's not a small thing to ask for help with something that you can't change. And I've done this again and again in my life. It's one of the ways that I've really learned the power of divine presence, the power of grace, in times when I've really felt my own inadequacy, or when there's been something that was disturbing me about myself and felt I couldn't change. I can remember one particular time when I was feeling extremely upset and in a bad mood, and I found myself speaking very sharply to someone I worked with, someone who was actually subordinate to me. So it was a situation in which I had some power. And when I left that encounter, I was filled with shame that I had spoken that way to that person. And I saw all the times in my life when I had spoken impatiently to somebody else because I was in a bad mood, or, you know, was angry about something or feeling insecure. And in that moment, I began to pray intensely, you know, I don't know what to do about this quality in myself. Please help me. And in that moment, something happened. It's not that I've never been impatient or, you know, spoken sharply. Of course I have. But one thing that I have never done is projected my own bad mood onto another person and felt justified in being cruel because I was feeling bad. Something about that prayer and the distress I was feeling opened up a doorway to transformation. So praying to the divine out of distress is a profoundly significant and important way of really opening yourself to Krishna's truth, Krishna's beauty, Krishna's presence. The second motive that we have for turning to divine is wanting a favor. And anyone who's really practiced prayer knows that this is what we automatically do, even if we are, you know, sophisticated New Age people and we don't do petitionary prayer. We do, you know, what is it called? Affirmative prayer. But when you really want to find a new house and you've looked all over and nothing is right, and at some point you turn inside and you say, if there is a house that I'm supposed to live in, can grace please find it for me? You know, it's a natural thing to do. In the Jewish tradition, they say that petitionary prayer is a way of affirming the dignity of human need, which I love. It's like, you know, it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to ask for divine help in succeeding. I never discovered this principle until my guru told me about it. And in fact, there are many stories about this in the tradition, but in my own case, my guru had asked me to arrange something that I had no confidence in my capacity to do, and he clearly saw my uncertainty. He saw that I was feeling like I couldn't do it. And he looked me in the eye and he smiled and he said, pray to Nityananda, who was his guru. He said, pray to my guru. Ask my guru to help you. And I did. I followed his instruction. I prayed for help and the thing happened. There are many stories about Ramakrishna, the great master, telling his disciples when they were in trouble to go to the temple and pray to the goddess, ask the goddess for help. He did it himself. So we turn to the divine for help in our material life unashamedly because we understand that the divine is in everything, that grace is in everything, that grace wants to help us. And somehow in the path of devotion, in the path of bhakti that Krishna is going to start to unfold, there's this enormous paradox that we are learning to act without attachment to the fruits. And yet in our relationship with the divine, we are never too proud to ask for help. I mean, it's such a paradoxical cusp that we live on, right? You know, like intending always to act in a non-egotistical way, in a way that doesn't privilege our own desires over others, and yet feeling completely comfortable asking for help in fulfilling those of our desires which are dharmic. In fact, it's one of the things that Krishna says in this chapter. I am the desire that is aligned with dharma. So the understanding here is that when we ask for help, we are asking for help when it's in alignment with the divine will, that's in alignment with truth, that's not harmful. So the third type of practitioner, the third type of seeker, as Krishna says, is the spiritual seeker who is actually motivated to turn to the divine for the sake of truth, who is seeking truth, who is seeking spiritual unfoldment, who's motivated by growth. You know, one of my teacher friends often says that what a true seeker is really always motivated by is the desire to grow, the desire to be more, the desire to be the best that one can be, the desire to expand consciousness. And this third type of seeker who finds ourselves on the spiritual path, and I think this is all of us, this is you and me and all of you here, something in us recognizes that the goals of life, of life in the so-called world, are not satisfying, that there is a depth in life that can't be found in career success or even in earthly love. Maybe you've had an awakening experience or an opening of the heart. But what you're looking for, what you're motivated for, what you're turning towards God for is a deep experience of the greatest form of growth, of maturity. And part of what Krishna says in this chapter is that we go through lifetime after lifetime of turning to the divine in distress or seeking material success or seeking the truth. You know, as we go through this process again and again and again until the moment when we become the fourth type of seeker, when we have begun to recognize that our own bodies and minds and the world around us is permeated with consciousness. When we become jnanis, or knowers of the truth, when we are able to actually open our eyes to the depths of what we are, to begin to recognize the intrinsic sacredness of life. And as Krishna goes on to say, in this fourth type of seeker, we begin to dissolve our separation in the recognition that the divine is everywhere. And we begin to find God in our own body in a natural way. So, in the week to come, I want to ask you to actually practice these four forms of seeking. Some of you may be more drawn to one than to the other. But part of what Krishna is saying is that what matters is really that we turn to him, that we turn to the truth. Whatever form your relationship with the divine takes, it's all taking you closer. Many of you know the story of the great 20th century Saint Shirdi Sai Baba, not the famous modern Sai Baba, but an earlier Sai Baba who lived in a very tiny hamlet in western India called Shirdi, and was known for granting people boons. So people would come to him to ask for help in finding a husband, or for opening a shop, or for paying a debt. And he would make these miracles. The stories about him are full of stories of these miracles that he created, you know, like just normal, like what would I say, miracles that irradiated their ordinary lives in very ordinary ways. You know, and these were mostly poor people who needed a lot of help in life. And he often used to say, people would ask him, you know, why is it that you're such a great realized being? Why do you perform all these miracles for people? He would say, I give people what they want so that they'll realize that I'm capable of giving them what I want to give them. In other words, I show people that I'm present to help so that sooner or later, as your consciousness matures and what you begin looking for is me, myself, is my own presence, that you'll know that that's possible. So the divine being, really, Shirdi Sai Baba was saying, is always beckoning you, longing for you, luring you, saying, okay, come to me, I'll give you what you want. And eventually, through my grace, you come to recognize that I can give you myself. There's this very beautiful story about Sai Baba, which apparently is true. You know, some of these stories about great sages are hagiography. They're not necessarily true, but apparently this one has really happened. So he had a disciple called Upasani Maharaj, who lived in a hut outside town. He was very dedicated and very lived a very simple life, and he used to beg Sai Baba to come and eat at his house. And finally, Sai Baba said, so, okay, I'm going to come tomorrow, prepare a lunch, I will be there. And at, just before lunch, the disciple Upasani Maharaj had made this curry, and he'd set it out on the table, when suddenly a dog leapt in through the window and began to eat the curry. And Upasani Maharaj was shocked, because in India dogs are not seen as auspicious pets but as pests, and he began to shoo the dog away and actually ended up hitting him and sending him off, scurrying off. And then Sai Baba never came. You know how the story works out, right? So the next day, Upasani went to see Sai Baba and said, you know, food was all ready. Why didn't you come? And Sai Baba said, I was there. I came. I ate your food. Vasani said, no, you didn't. And Sai Baba said, I was that dog. And then he took off his shirt and showed Upasani the mark on his back where Upasani had hit the dog. So these stories that this story and other stories like it are really, the point of them is to show us that the divine is everywhere, is in everyone. And Krishna says in the next verse, in whatever way you worship me, however you see me, I will make your faith strong and I'll fulfill your desires. So it doesn't really matter if you see me as your teacher, if you see me as the goddess, if you see me as Krishna, if you see me as a mountain or a tree or your own house, whatever form you see me in, whatever way you love and honor me, whatever way, whatever person you love and honor, what you're loving and honoring is me. So, you know, there's this, again, very famous story about Ramakrishna, who had a disciple who said to him, who came to him, a woman disciple, and said, you know, I just do not love God. I don't love you. I don't love the deity in the temple. I just don't feel any love for God. And Ramakrishna said, well, who do you love? Again, this is a very famous story. The woman said, I love my nephew. So Ramakrishna said, that's beautiful. Think of your nephew as Krishna. Think of your nephew as God. Love your nephew as God, and God will come to you through your nephew. And what he goes on to say is that whatever we give our life and our attention to is actually a form of worship, and our attention is a form of devotion. So, and he's going to continue with this in the next chapter. The object of your devotion can be your work. It can be art. It can be political activism. It can be literature. You can be totally devoted to your children or your romantic partner or to your house. And if in your devotion you see God in that, you see the divine in that, then the divine will appear as that. The great eco-philosopher David Abram, who has written wonderful books about finding the divine through the senses, tells a story about how he was living in Bali. I think he was an anthropologist. And his landlady in Bali used to put food out every day on a banana leaf for the spirits of the land that the house was built on. It was part of her religious practice. And David Abram said that, of course, he would see that ants would eat the food. In other words, she would put it out every day for the spirits, but actually it was being eaten by ants and maybe small rats and mammals. And at first, in his, you know, kind of Western intellectual superiority, he would think, oh, she's just deceiving herself and thinking that this food is being eaten by the spirits. And then one day he had a revelation that the spirits who she put the food out for were in the ants and in the mice. And that whatever it was that ate her food was eating it on behalf of the divine. So whatever you devote yourself to, Krishna will appear through that. The divine will appear through that. And again, this is another way of saying that the satisfaction you experience in your life through your relationships, through your work, you know, through giving a talk and having everybody like it, or, you know, playing music and feeling that you've succeeded in it, the satisfaction that you feel in all of this, the rewards you feel in all of this, comes from Krishna. And the source of the reward, and this is, of course, very significant, is the feeling you put into it. In other words, what connects us to the divine in our actions is our feeling, because feeling is self, is one of the doorways through which divine grace reveals itself to us. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that because the one divine consciousness is in everything, that you can find the divine through any form of practice, and that therefore there is no form of spiritual practice or even life practice which should be looked on as less than any other. Because if what you're doing is sincerely offering to whatever it is that you love, Krishna is in your actions, the divine is in the object that you are offering honor and respect to. And this, you know, this anti-fundamentalist viewpoint, it's one of the you know, really beautiful teachings that comes out through the life of Ramakrishna. You know, he actually tested this statement from the Gita. He practiced several different spiritual paths, including Krishna worship, including non-dual Vedanta, including tantric goddess worship. He also practiced Christianity, and he did Muslim worship, and he discovered for himself that the same experience of the great love is in all these paths. The only mistake we make, Krishna says, and of course we all make it, is to believe that the form is the goal, that the practice is the goal, whereas the deeper truth is that everything that we find through practice, every different energy signature of every different deity form, including our own consciousness, is a doorway into awareness bliss, is a doorway into the divine. And part of what he is telling Arjuna when he talks about the fourth type of seeker, the one who is the knower of the truth, is that the more we begin to recognize that underlying presence, that basic divine presence, the more we are infused by grace. In fact, Abhinavagupta says the true sign that we've received the fullness of grace is that we're able to see, if only for a moment, how the divine has become everything. And what this means is that you have begun to recognize that your true self, the consciousness that has become you, is not only the witness of the play of the world, but is also playing in and as the world. And that means that even when you're having a bad day, even when the country is having a bad 4 years, nonetheless, Krishna is in all of it. And remember, Krishna means God. Krishna means Shiva. Krishna means Kali. Krishna means divine consciousness. Krishna means truth. Krishna means love. Krishna is just a shorthand for that all-pervading grace that is constantly out of love, uplifting us. So we're going to sit for a longer time. We're going to sit with the mantra Om Namo Narayanaya, which is so filled with Krishna's presence and grace. And we're going to practice in the Sushumna Nadi as we were doing earlier, allowing the breath to flow in through the center of the head and down to the heart, and to flow up from the heart to the center of the head with this divine thought, Om Namo Narayanaya, flowing in and flowing out. Om Namo Narayanaya. Through this mantra and the recognition that it's infused with divine presence, see if you can allow the breath which comes out of divine presence to flow down the center of your body and expand your awareness in whatever way wants to happen. Your action of allowing the breath to mingle with the mantra, your practice, is an offering to that divine self that lives in everything. And in this practice is also the intention to know that, to know that the self lives in words, in mantras, in breath, in the body. So in practicing Om Namo Narayanaya with the breath, you're also practicing the non-dual awareness that everything that arises inside and outside is sacred consciousness itself. Om Namo Narayanaya, flowing with the breath, flowing as an offering, flowing naturally, allowing meditation to happen on its own. As thoughts arise, consider that the thoughts too are aspects of Krishna, are aspects of consciousness, are aspects of Shakti. As sensations arise and subside in the body, recognize them too as being made of Krishna's being. As sounds come into your field, as your eyes see forms, recognize that they too are suffused with Krishna's being. Om Namo Narayanaya, the breath, the inner body, and the recognition that everything is your own self, and that yourself is consciousness, and that this consciousness is the same divine consciousness that has become everything that exists and everything that potentially exists and everything beyond existence. Om Namo Narayanaya. that consciousness through which you experience the world is the divine consciousness that is its source. So as we go into the evening or the day with the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya, we offer our practice . We offer the actions of our body and our mind to that which is at the heart of all. Asking that all beings know that truth, feel that love, live in the awareness that this divine being is making present for each of us all the time, for love, for wisdom, for truth. Namaste. Have a beautiful, beautiful week. The homework will be coming tomorrow, and of course the call will be available. Thank you so much. Namaste.